All right, well, listen, we're not going to be talking about Buffy or MTV or Friends or anything like that for the next hour and a bit, whatever it takes. So, unfortunately, it's not going to be TV programs we're going to be dealing with, but I'm trying to make this fun. Just by way of warm-up into what I want to get to, I just want you to sort of think a minute of the ways and the devices of kind of retaining contact with people, keeping in touch, connecting with people, friends, family, so on and so forth. Not so much for your business lives, but for your kind of personal lives, for you, you know. What do you do? How do you do it? Just tell me.
The cell phone.
The phone. Okay. And?
Email.
Cards and letters.
Yeah.
Okay. So, email and then mail. Okay. Phone, email, mail. What else?
Instant messenger.
Instant messenger.
Just when you're online, instead of like sending an actual email, you just
send out back and forth.
Chat things.
Okay.
Two-way message. Is it the same thing? Two-way.
You mean like not a radio? I wasn't talking about like two-way radio. I was talking about just on
those flip pages with the keypad.
Yeah. Oh no, that's something different.
Okay. Two-way. Oh, is that a two-way pages? Okay. Anything else? Anything I'm missing? When you say phone, do you mean a particular kind of phone or just phone?
Cell phone.
Cell phones. Anything else?
Just a regular phone at home.
Regular phone. Okay, good. I've got the worst handwriting on earth, by the way, but it scribbles for me rather than for you. Okay. Now we've got regular phone, email, mail, instant messaging, which I guess kind of comes back to email, two-way pages, cell phones, maybe there's some other things too. Out of this kind of list of stuff, are there things on there that you found yourself doing more of over time, and some things that you found yourself doing less of over time?
Yeah, less mail.
More email.
So less of that, and more of
email.
That.
Okay. Less of home phone, more cell phone.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah.
Can you?
It's cheaper.
Well, okay. More convenient. Can you talk to me about that? What's going on? Why more of one and less of the other?
Don't spend a lot of time
home.
At home.
Yeah,
you
don't spend much time there.
Okay. Well, like, I'm from Washington, D.C., and I moved out here, and so my cell phone plan, I get unlimited night and weekend minutes, so, you know, I'm not going to sit at home my long distance and pay for it when I pay, like, $40 a month, and I can talk for, you know, 8 hours, 10 hours, you know, all weekend long.
Okay.
Or all night long.
There's a better chance we'll actually get them if you call on the cell phone than the phone.
Really?
You don't see the message. What?
There's a better chance of actually get the person if you call on the cell phone.
Oh, yeah?
Okay.
I hate leaving messages. That's just a weird thing.
I personally prefer landline. I hate being on a cell phone and feeling like it's me.
Yeah, exactly.
So, okay. As I use the landline.
Okay, so we've got some of you getting hot ears by using cell phones and preferring landlines. Some of you prefer to use cell phones because they're cheaper than landlines. What else between these two things?
I think since I got a cell phone,
yeah.
I started using that more.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Why? Just because it was
right there.
More than your landline, you mean? Or?
Mm-hmm. Like I went without a cell phone for years, and then I got a cell phone, and I found myself stuck in traffic, and then I'd just call somebody.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I drive a lot too, and I feel like I've been able to keep contact with people more because it's available to me in the car, which I wouldn't have had a 2-hour drive and waste of time.
Okay.
I don't even use my cell
phone. You don't use it?
Only for work now. It drives me crazy. Everybody calls it.
So you put like a kind of limit on it in terms of your social life?
As soon as I'm life. Home, it goes off. And I'd rather people call the house so I can see who's calling me. And then if I don't want to talk,
I don't. So this way you can kind of screen who's coming in.
Exactly. But my cell phone has caller ID, so
is mine.
If I don't want to talk to anyone, I just don't answer.
Okay. Screen or caller ID.
I don't even give my home phone number out to people anymore.
My wife would rather give out the cell number than the home number for privacy reasons, especially to telemarketers.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
because she doesn't want them to disturb us at home.
But they can't reach you when you're on the cell phone.
It's not available. We don't keep this on all the time,
yeah.
So if they call and leave a message, then we can call them back at our own time, or they just miss that opportunity.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Kang. It's a pleasure to begin this symposium. I've been asked to speak about the pathophysiology of photoaging, and as well some of the manifestations of photoaging. So on the left is a picture of an individual who went to Aruba, and this is one single sunburn on the back. This is a 23-year-old person. You can see where the bathing suit was, and you can see in this great illustration the profound damage that can be brought, most probably due to mutations, multiple mutations in many cell types, melanocytes, no doubt keratinocytes, which this individual will carry forever, because it's very, very likely that many of these are in the stem cells. So this is what happens after a single severe sunburn. In chronic sun exposure, you have a picture that looks like this, where you have brown spots, you have wrinkles. The wrinkles are of the coarse sort, and this is a fairly good example here, but I chose this mainly to show the brown spots, because the brown spots are one of the major targets of retinoid treatment. Now, although sun causes major damage in terms of immunosuppression, mutations, certain kinds of skin cancer, the focus of my discussion today is going to be on the connective tissue, in other words, the extracellular matrix that brings these types of changes after long-term sun exposure. The left-hand side of this individual's face is worse than the right hand. This is part of a study of several hundred patients where we showed that the side that is exposed to the window when you drive has the majority of the sun damage, and people in other parts of the world have found it to be on the other side of the face when they drive on the other side of the road. So it's very, very likely, the far and away the most likely environmental insult would be sunlight. So what? How does this come about? That's really the subject of my talk today. Here's an ordinary histology slide, and the epidermis being extremely thin, an order of a tenth of a millimeter, you can read newsprint through it, cannot be the source of these wrinkles. It is certainly the source of various kinds of cancer, but not the wrinkling. And so it's our belief that the major molecule participating here is collagen. And there are many kinds of collagen, but 90% of the mass of the dermis is type 1 collagen. And the other major collagen is collagen 3. I'm only going to talk about collagen 1 today, because collagen 3 tracks in terms of its regulation and changes identically with collagen 1. So you can just assume that they're both the same. We do have the data, we have done it, and that is the way it is. So that this eosinophilic, I guess on this slide it's more bluish, but on a non-PowerPoint presentation, you know that it's eosinophilic when you see it in a microscope, and it's responsible for the form and the strength and the function of skin. So this is the major focus of our work. We're aware that elastin is there, but for a variety of reasons that I will go into, if you want, during the discussion, I can tell you why I don't think elastin is a key part of what we're talking about. Elastin is important to elastosis, the yellowish nodular changes and so forth. But remember, what I'm talking about here is the genesis of wrinkling. So collagen per se is not that easy to measure. So the vast majority of individuals, ourselves included, measure procollagen. We measure that in various ways. We have a number of techniques that I'll show you. And then collagen, once it's formed, is degraded into collagen fragments. First, taken down by collagenase into two fragments, three-quarters of the length of this molecule and one-quarter, those two fragments. And then gelatinase will work on those fragments and take it down to very small pieces. And so one can measure the downregulation of collagen by either collagenase assays or gelatinase, and there are various ways of doing that, from activity to gene expression, protein content, etc. And then, of course, we can measure collagen fragments. And once you see collagen fragments, you know that you've had the activity of these two enzymes. Now, the point of departure of our work has been really an axiom that you'll have to agree with, otherwise you might as well go out and expose yourself to the sun. Incidentally, it's a great thing that you're here, because about 5 minutes we have shown in our early work, 5 minutes of the kind of sun that's outside today will absolutely, definitely kick off all the biochemistry that I will talk about a little later.
When is the last time anybody really paid attention to the face of a general on horseback in a park? Who cares? I mean, monuments that I thought were absolutely fabulous when I was younger, I really question what I ever saw in them, and there's awfully a lot of pollution, and wouldn't most people really rather have a Burger King on that spot anyway? I mean, the world is nuts. And I'm making a lot of art historical little references, sort of for my own games. But, you know, I enjoy it. If anybody sees it, fine, and if they don't, that's okay, too. That certainly is not of primary importance. Well, I'm not sure the idea of anti-monument is that well developed in my mind. Certainly art as clutter is a very big deal to me. I mean, I recycle everywhere I can. I don't like using plastic utensils unless I can rewash them 100 times and feel justified in having wasted the whatever. But then I'm physically making all of this stuff, and every artist I know is, and we're pouring out vast quantities of things. And I sometimes wonder if I'm improving the culture we live in or if I'm adding to the clutter. And I'm thinking of the mountains of abandoned computers out there all over the place, making trash mountains of technological things, and we haven't figured out what to do with the old trash mountains. And, you know, you look around and see badly deteriorated public art that nobody has cared for or loved, and the physical man hours that went into these things, and you wanted so much more for them, and you wanted, you know, our public art to be so incredible, and it isn't. Unfortunately, I'm as guilty as a lot of other artists in earlier pieces that I've made being put in places that I'm a little ashamed of in terms of how they're kept or what's behind them or, you know, whatever, having no control once it leaves the artist's studio. And I just sort of started thinking that, you know, we're tripping over stuff. And maybe it's interesting in itself. I don't know. Again, when I went to school, there was a tremendous emphasis on it wasn't good unless it was enormous. If you couldn't pick it up with a forklift, who was interested in this thing? And yet I do have a certain nostalgia for the idea of a precious object. We are in an ephemeral throwaway kind of a world, and I still like the idea there's something out there to treasure. Now, I'm not talking about Fabergé eggs, which don't interest me at all. I like the fact that originally I thought this thing was going to be put on the floor, and people said, well, somebody might bump into it and kick it. And I said, well, okay, if they do, they'll scratch the patina. So what? It's bronze, but it's not really precious. And that's one of the reasons I like the fact that it was bronze. Had I made it in the same plastic compound that I was making these little wall pieces, if you tripped over one, you'd break it. Whereas this stuff's more durable. Now, you probably could trash it if you threw it over the side of the building or something, but bronze historically has this reputation of being fairly solid and something that'll hold up, even though the surface will scratch. And I like the idea of trying to make something that was sort of anti-precious. Well, I think the museum had a little problem with the idea of setting it up in such a way that people could walk through it, and by the time I put this floor under it, unfortunately, it's just little planks of that Pergo stuff you buy at Home Depot, and if people walked on it, it would probably come apart, because they're just sort of locked in together. Ideally, if I had set this thing up the way I wanted, it would just be on some pretty floor somewhere all by itself without a carpet or a flooring or anything and without any markers around it. But that's impractical in a museum context. But I'm hoping that, you know, people can imagine themselves in this walking through a room of it. It's not that big a section. you know, that they actually need to get the idea, I hope. Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely, it changed it a lot, because going from the wall to the floor, you're going from, what is the word I'm looking for, an illusionist space and a pictorial space almost, even though these were three-dimensional objects, to the real space in which you live, so that then something becomes far more animated and plausibly lifelike. I mean, obviously no one's going to look at these things and think they're looking at real animals. I'm not, you know, expecting that anybody's going to think of them as real in any way, except for having maybe the imagination or the potential of living or having once lived.